thing down.
Started to record again. Bucky would pick up precisely the point where he had left off. It was incredibly, you know. And it's a, you know, it's indicative of the fact that he's completely attuned to the to this contemporary work. You know?
Well, another thing that I don't know, but I have been intensely interested in visual images in my early youth. And when I was about 13 years old, I lost one of my eyes to an accident. And I've often wondered if possibly the preoccupation of having lost the sight in that eye might in some way account for some hypertrophy in the direction of using the other one. Also, I must confess, I think, say the normal ways we have for visualizing spatial relationships in an abstract way, that is through drawing, diagramming, and things of that sort, are basically one-eyed men's games.
You really think so?
Oh, yes. The perspective systems imply a singular station point of the observer.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But a singular station point of the observer is not a one-eyed thing. It's a binocular, it's a stationary binocular thing.
You do not do drawings with binocular stereopsis. You do them essentially as monocular things. And I have found with students with two eyes, in many instances, it is more difficult for them to see an abstract spatial relationship because the drawing systems that they have to use seem to be strangely and unaccountably at variance with the direct experiences they're having in the world.
I have to think about that. That's a new thought that I have to.
Well, I am somewhat convinced anyway that that was a, might be partially influential in my preoccupation with these things. I think the discovery in the interregnum of my preoccupation in high school and college with the fine arts, whatever was rigorous about that tended to be in other directions than the abstraction of spatial relationships. It was more the abstraction of perceptual images. And there was some fairly routine cognitive processes that one went through, but the focus was primarily in the perceptual image. And one of the, I suppose, delights of getting into the design environment was the discovery that I enjoyed the cognitive processes every bit as much as the perceptual process. In fact, in some way that I enjoyed them more. And it was like tasting perhaps red meat for the first time or something of that sort. Getting over here, then it became quite a fascinating preoccupation. As you well know, painting gradually took to the back burner and finally disappeared. And I haven't regretted that particularly. I know that others have perhaps, but it hasn't bothered me all that. Stop. And I discovered, with a little effort on my part, that I was reasonably competent at it. And where I was incompetent, I discovered by some looking at some textbooks and figuring some things out, I could become competent. I could have problems any really bad trouble, teaching myself what I needed to know to go on dealing with that in a fairly rigorous way. And I think part of the productiveness of it then was not only that you were able to personally develop the tools to deal with the issues that you felt you had to deal with, but there was reinforcement from colleagues. That is, when you did that, and you did something based on that, there was some reinforcement to you from your colleagues for having done it. Some interchange, some exchange of ideas, rather than sort of dull silence.
Where'd you get that reinforcement from here? Obviously from Fitz, because Fitz was experimenting in the same way.
Well, we were reinforcing each other, but from John Nelman, from Lee Hodgson, from the students, from Bucky,
let me ask you,
Henry Camp Heffernan.
That's the difficult question, I think, isn't it? What was Henry's position and influence in this area?
Henry really didn't understand what was going on, but at a gonad level, Henry had some incredible understanding. I don't think he understood how he understood, in a way. But he had a sense about that. And if somebody was actively engaged in something and it felt somehow to him productive, even if he didn't quite know what it was, he's quite willing to support it. And he didn't have to have logic or rationality or anything else like that to cause him to act on the basis of his feelings about things.
If Henry, in the period, say, Oklahoma, when he was contemplating coming here and bringing the movie here, if there was no strong preconceived notion that this was going to be a school which would emphasize construction, structure, and those kinds of issues. Do you feel that once these things started here, seeing you getting involved with Bucky, having Bucky here, by the way, let me just, who was the one that discovered Bucky and brought him here?
Fitz was had two commissions over in Tennessee that he was finishing up the summer before we were to start here in the fall. And he decided, he'd heard of Black Mountain College, and he decided to stop by there on his way over to Raleigh. And who should he run into there but Bucky Fuller and a group of students, I think Jeff Lindsay, Don Richter, Ken Snelson. And he got to talking to Bucky and came on over to school. The semester began, and Henry had a fairly munificent visiting lecturer stipend. And Jim immediately got in there and said, we've got to invite this guy over to talk to us about what he's engaged in. And I don't know that Henry had anything but a peripheral acquaintance with Bucky. He knew he'd been connected with Starling Burgess, and he knew that he'd been doing something with something called the Dymaxion House, and something to do with a three-wheeled automobile and so on. But that'd be an okay thing to do.
Was your knowledge of Bucky any deeper than Henry's at that particular
time?
Well,
it was even less deep. Mm-hmm. Bucky burst upon me as a totally new phenomenon. I'd never run into a guy like this before. I'd never even heard of him, really. Oh, I'd heard the name. But mainly I'd heard of Starling Burgess, who had been a yacht designer and an aircraft designer and things of that sort, which was close to my interests. But I thought Bucky was sort of hanging on Starling's coattails rather than the other way around.
What's happened to Starling?
I think he died. I think he was an older fellow. He was much older than Bucky. But he was involved in some really very interesting designs of aircraft in World War I. A tailless aircraft that apparently flew quite well. It was quite an interesting aircraft. And he was also the designer of some of, I think, the cup racing, the British cup racing things that Thomas Lipton had attempted to use
to lift the American cup?
Yeah.
That's the first time I've heard Starman's name come up. It'd be interesting to see what that
process is. Well, he was the designer with a guy named Dunn of an old seaplane called the Burgess Dunn seaplane toward the tail end of World War I. It was a tailless aircraft that apparently flew quite well and it was very efficient for its time.
Well, so Bucky comes here and when did Roy Gusso come? Fairly early in the...
Yes, I can't remember whether his was the 48-49 school year or 49-50. It was either one or the other, and I cannot remember. I have a vague feeling that it might have been first crack out of the box, because we had a whole raft of freshmen that we had to deal with. And as I recall, Lasky and Gusso appeared more or less at that time. There was Shasha and myself and Lasky and Gusso. Melman. I think we had to have six sections. The basic design program. That's the only way we could have done it.
Well, so, you know, here's Roy involved in a way, in spatial geometry and hyperbolic,
and
a lot of other things. And then, so Bucky comes here. The first year that Bucky was here, did he run student design projects or did he just lecture about?
No. There was no student design project.
Did he have the Airstream trailer first year with all the models in it and everything?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His goodie boxes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, he did. No, he came the second year and had a student design project at that time. Then he came a third year with a student design project. And the third year, I think, was at Marine Corps.
Now, the second year he was here must have been that automated textile factory that they did.
No, that came after, that was about the fourth time he was here. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not.
No, it was maybe certainly maybe before
was,
the Marine
Corps. That was the second one. Okay. T.C. Howard was involved in that one. Then the Marine Corps thing, or no, I think the next one was the greenhouse.
Yeah, we did the greenhouse. See, the greenhouse was what I was involved in, and the Marine Corps thing I was involved in. And the textile factory was before that, so
the
it must have been
factory,
the greenhouse.
That's right, I think you're right.
It must have been the year before.
Yeah.
So
then he came another time in which, for a shorter period of time, which he just went through energetic geometry again.
So you were
the mapping with the student.
Oh, that's right.
With
Shoji Sadao.
With Shoji Sadao and Tony Lee. And, but that was at the time when Synergetics and the Skybreak Carolina Corporation and Geodesics Incorporated were getting underway. And there was a period of several years there up until the early 60s when Bucky was in town quite regularly, not so much connected with the school as connected with business enterprises.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to your orderly subdivision of spheres. That certainly generated out of Bucky's.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In which both the question of spherical geometry, close packing, a whole variety of things.
Well, Bucky and Jeff Lindsay and Don Richter have spent an incredible amount of time, apparently one summer, up in Montreal, trying to get that geodesic grid worked out. And, oh, it'd be kind of funny. Bucky's romantic relationships with mathematics sort of had their penultimate confrontation there. They kept subdividing that grid with the way Bucky really thought God intended that it be subdivided, but there was always a failure to close in terms of geometry, and with all of the points that were off of the boundary of the increment that was being modulated. And Bucky was absolutely convinced, because the window was so small, that it was the fault of trig tables, that there were errors in trig tables, and if he could get, say, if he had 8 place tables, if he could get a hold of some 15 place tables, that window would disappear. I found some fairly simple, straightforward geometric constructions that clearly stated that the window was there, that there was no possibility of closure. So I tried to convince Bucky that it was not the fault of the trig tables. And with some justice, Bucky sort of sneered at me and said, well, you're really kind of a tyro as a mathematician, aren't you? So what sort of attention, basically, should I pay to what you're telling me? And I had to admit he was right. I had to untyro myself so far as the mathematics as that was concerned. I proceeded to do that. Then, you know, it's one of those funny experiences that one has. I'm sure it's happened to you at one time or another, where you're immersed in a problem. And this happened to be a geometric problem. And somehow you have assembled all of the data, or whatever, that is necessary to solve the problem. But you haven't put it all together, so that it's still kind of an enigma in your mind as to what in hell is going on. And I can remember lying on my back one night, a hot night out there when we lived on Dixie Trail, and out of somewhere, God knows where, came a simple chain of thought where I knew without even having to check it, I had dealt with that problem. But that was it. That worked. Those geodesic lines crossed. There was no window. And it was so ridiculously simple to do. I said, why in hell hasn't somebody stumbled onto this before? I'm sure they have. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah.
You don't know where it comes from, but you know when it's there. You're absolutely certain that that's it. And you're so certain, you say, Jesus Christ, what's the big deal about that? And that was when, say, the germ of the idea of the orderly subdivision of spheres became possible. But I could begin to see this was so simple and so direct that it could become a quite general method for doing that. And interestingly enough, T.C. Howard has come up with some non-geodesic ways of subdividing spheres, which open a whole new package of things that never occurred at that time, that are equally or perhaps even more fascinating than that one. I've never gotten around to facing that issue, but TC has done some really beautiful stuff there.
Did the whole issue of close packing come out of the connection with Bucky, or the connection with the product design people, or what?
Well, that was a mixture of working with Bucky and working in the basic design studios with student efforts to put various kinds of configurations together. Which in turn led to questions, which in turn led to reading of the literature, which in turn led to more questions. And finally, up with, you know, these damn things right here. It's a completely new phenomenon that has some incredible packing properties. And this isn't in the literature anywhere. This is a very strange bird.
What kind of geometric form is that? That's a
Parallel pipettes having exactly the same faces, the same numbers and kinds of faces, but quite different. And all of their dihedral angles are integral multiples of 360 degrees, so that they will stack up around an edge and pack an edge. That is, this dihedral is 36, this is 144, this is 72, this is 108. And these are in the ratio of the golden section. So it's a very strange creature which leads to the packing of space. I would suspect, this is one of the things I'm working on right now. It turns out that those two things will pack space either by themselves or together. Probably, I would estimate, if you include handedness, that is right-handedness and left-handedness in terms of configuration, there may be as many as 600 or 700 different ways those two things can pack themselves around one point in space. There are over 70 ways they can, different ways they can pack themselves around an edge. Which leads to a statement I think can be safely said, that you can pack these in a sense orderly arrays of points in space. They have some kind of order, but they would be completely non-periodic. That is, any localized phenomena that you might find in one region of the space, there is no reason why you would ever have to find it again anywhere else in a completely packed space. Now that's strange, isn't it? They can be periodic, they do not have to be periodic. And the symmetries that it is based on are the five-way symmetries of, say, icosahedron and dodecahedron, which do not occur in nature in crystalline forms at all. But they do apparently occur in some ways, it has a closer affinity to biological structures.
And that's what you're into now. You're
yeah.
Let's flip back again. You know, if you look at that period, say, Duncan, between 1948 and what? 56, 57, 58, that first decade, or first 6 to 8 years to 10 years of the school. It was, at least in my view, was a particularly vibrant, creative period at the school. You know.
No question about it.
There were things that were going on that, I must be very frank, I have not found replicated in any other school in the country.
Well, I think of Jim Fitzgibbon, for example, where he had an intuitive feeling about ideas, kind of romantic feeling about the ideas that lay behind them, which he seemed to comprehend quite well. But he was much more interested in not the idea, but how would you make one? How do you actually carry it out and see a thing that is the result of that? The idea that lay behind it was really not that intriguing to Jim. Well, I think of that fantastic exercise he went through out there. Remember where they were using Venetian blind stock and trying to build the tallest tower they could out of Venetian blind stock from the bottom and simply rolling it up and tying it. You know, that whole thing was just fantastic.
Well, looking back at it, Duncan, in retrospect, what were the essential ingredients that made that particular time so radically different from what's happened, say, in the last decade and a half? Let me just put that in a little into context. Look, we used to think, some of us used to think in those days, certainly our Nervi articulated it, that structure was the most important determining element in form. That if you had a rational structure that was related to a rational method of construction, that in itself had inherent beauty. And that was the sine qua non of really built aesthetic. We're a little older and a little more mature, a little less, I don't know, romantic now. So we don't consider it to have been the only thing. But a lot of other things have happened in architectural education, which have had the same feelings. You know, that if you had a good method of approaching design, that was it. Or if the psychology of the behavior of the people were looked at, that was it. None of them have really ever generated the same kind of enthusiastic creativity.
Well, I think there might be some reasons that one could point to. First of all, the structuralism could be firmly based on, I won't say truths, but some fairly firmly based beliefs that grew out of the physical sciences. That is, there were such things as we thought of conservation laws, of resolution of forces, that where one could determine quite unambiguously whether something was or was not stable. One could kick and touch and feel the behavior of something. There was always a physical embodiment of the principle, embodimentability of the principle that you might be dealing with at the time. I think one of the difficulties to me now is, if anything, is that we have tried to face other aspects of the design problem, which quite frankly we had left out. And we have tried to perhaps use the same kinds of techniques. We have tried to assume, not only designers, but the world in general, that there are some things which we call social sciences. And in the sense of the physical sciences, that simply is not true. If we say that science has to be based on some set of guiding principles, there are no such guiding principles in the social sciences. There is only a kind of empiricism and pragmatism that has nothing comparable to a conservation law or a stability test, which allow you to predict much of anything. So, either rightly or wrongly, have assumed that we were going to be able to pummel what we referred to as the social sciences into genuinely being sciences. And they have intractably refused. So that, I don't know that this is a blind alley. I've got to convince myself, I suppose, that it is not. But I think that we have to be willing to say that there's going to be a continuing, very subjective component that is going to be unerasable, ineradicable, so far as those things are concerned, at least in the foreseeable future.
Well, that's interesting because you see the bias of the social sciences, the bias of the methodologists, the bias of these people is to reduce to at least a minimum, at best nothing, the subjective and intuitive elements of design. It's interesting that we talk about intuition in dealing with structuralism, in dealing with construction. And we talk about process, rationality, methodology, in dealing with the social sciences, in dealing with design method, in dealing with all those other things. And if you look at what you've just said, you would think it would be precisely the other way around.
Yeah, that's kind of screwy, isn't it? Well, I think Bernd Schobrin sorted that one out in a nice way for me several years ago when he pointed out something that I had not realized, the sort of slippery use we make of words, where we tend to almost indiscriminately equate, say, things like difficulty and complexity as being simply different sides of the same coin. And yet, I think we really think about it, we have sort of two axes with four words, in a sense, that there is a simple to complex axis, and perpendicular to that, let's say, there is an easy to difficult axis. And generally, the way we deal with complexity is to reduce it to a series of simple steps. But so far, we have never found a way of genuinely facing a difficulty and reducing it to a series of easy steps.
Would it be possible that's a three-axis thing?
It could
from
be.
From simple to complex, from difficult to easy, and from small to large?
Could be.
Because one of the other problems is we tend to equate smallness with simpleness, largeness with complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what the methodologists and the process people essentially have been trying to do is to say, how do I take that which I perceive as difficult in the design process and find some way of turning it into a complexity so that I can deal with it in some way by a series of simple steps rather than a series of easy steps. And if there's any way that I can find of rephrasing the question which appears to be difficult so that it appears to be merely a complex question, then I can deal with it. If I can rotate it 90 degrees, or close thereto, it becomes manageable in some way. But an awful lot of problems, apparently, a lot of the stuff that I think Christopher Alexander talks about in Notes and Synthesis of Form, he finally had to admit, I think, in a number of instances in that book, where he said that there are an awful lot of problems, for instance, in design that are resolved by tradition. The traditional growth of a pattern. And when new things come in where there is no tradition, we have to devise a process for dealing with them. He hasn't really been able to do that very well. The things really don't work out. They are not reducible to mere complexities. And he gave it a good try. But I think, from what I hear, he has more or less given up, sort of given up on the issue.
And he's into another totally different betting, totally different area. Well, in retrospect, Duncan, you know, what do you feel were the unique characters just of the school here, you know, that made that period so?
Oh, I think there's no question in my mind that its characteristics were a collection of people genuinely interested in doing something, who did not look upon each other as threats, but as colleagues on some kind of a common journey. And a great deal of mutual enthusiasm about what other people were doing other than oneself. That one felt that one was an individual and was capable of contributing something, not of oneself, to a more general thing that was bigger than you felt than yourself.
I think it was a mutual compatibility and a mutual supportive mechanism.
And at the times when the school has been like that, I think any school has been like that, and it's been productive. And when walls start growing up between one segment of the faculty and another, clearly defined walls, they may be there, invisible wall that you don't even pay much attention to, and that's not so bad. But when the walls are really overt there, and you can see each guy's Berlin Wall daily being built in one way or another, the productiveness gets worked out. Each guy becomes a kind of island. And the paranoia grows. And one becomes ingrown, protective of one's personal prerogatives or personal domain, personal territory. One becomes more of an animal, let's say, at that point. Well, this is one of the difficulties the school's going through right now. This school. And I suppose, I sense an awful lot of schools in this country, but there does not appear to be an idea sufficiently strong, sufficiently larger than the individual components of the school. The people will put aside their natural pettiness to become a part of it. And most of us are fairly petty. You've got to admit that. Left to our own devices, we are that way. We're no different than anybody else.
Well, I appreciate it.
Well, I think with Bucky at times, I know he strives manfully to not be petty.
But Bucky can be petty.
Oh, can he ever?
Well,